I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is Duray, and welcome to Posse of the People. In this episode, it is me, DR, Kaya, and Miles talking about all the news you don't know from the past week, all the news with regard to race, justice, and equity that you missed, but you should know. And welcome to the month of May. We talk about Biden's re-election campaign, mass layoffs within the news industry, confiscated funds from people who are incarcerated and their commissary accounts, and even more. We have a lot of interviews coming up this month. Here we go.
Welcome to another episode of Pod Save the People, family. It's so good to be back with you. Another exciting episode, exciting talk, exciting news. I'm Kaya Henderson at Henderson Kaya on Twitter.
I'm Mousy Johnson. I am Pharaoh Rapture on Twitter and Instagram and Pinterest.
Diara Ballinger at Diara Ballinger on Instagram.
This is Duray, D-I-Y on Twitter.
So family, a lot has happened this week. First of all, our current president, Joe Biden, has declared his candidacy for the 2024 election. What do you think about that?
I want to be told what to think about that. So,
well, I don't know what to think about that. I mean, there has been lots of talk about how Mr. Biden is too old to run for president. He'll be 82, I think, at the time that he is, if he is successful, and hopefully will finish his term at 86. Good golly, math is failing me this morning. And lots of people, all of the scuttlebutt is that that he is not fit mentally, or he's too old, or he doesn't have enough energy. In fact, that was many of the jokes this weekend at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And there are lots of people, I think I saw a poll that said more than half of the country said that they would rather see younger people engaged in a presidential race, because I think Donald Trump will be 78 or something like that. So we'll have two significantly older gentlemen if the race were today as the leading front runners.
You know, Kaya, sometimes I feel like I'm the only one who remembers Donald Trump sometimes during certain conversations. Because, like, if you're saying, oh, I think Biden's unfit, I'm like, were we not just there together?
Yes, well.
Was that a dream? Like, let me know if everybody does not remember the most unfit as far as Big Macs, unfit as far as mental health, unfit as far as just ability at the job.
So I'm the trauma response. It's the trauma response. You suppress the things that were traumatic.
Yeah, because I'm like, oh, believe me, we can get through this again. We can get through. Biden is not the most unfit that we've seen.
And I think from the left.
That's what we're going for, Miles. The least unfit.
And it's like, you know,
so inspiring.
Say what you will about Biden, he has lasted. And that's half the game in politics. He has been in the game for a long time. He is old. I'm worried about the age thing, but not just worried about him. I think about Feinstein is still, you know, Feinstein staying in the Senate is screwing us up with the court. So there are a lot of really old people in office, and I don't know how that changes until we change the way that money moves.
If he dies, doesn't the vice president become president?
Yes. Yes, sir. Which is why apparently he's touting her very prominently in his campaign video.
So I think it's a win-win. I think let's celebrate that if Kamala Say gets into now? Office. It's a win-win if he dies. We by hooks or crooks got a black woman in the presidency. Are we gonna act? What's wrong with that? I'm tired of acting like when people who die who are over 85. I'm tired of acting like it's.
I think people who die after 85 have had a pretty good run. God bless them. That's not the part I'm worried about.
Are you afraid that Kamala's gonna put half the nation in jail?
I just think if we could not muster up enough to have her as a serious presidential candidate, then I don't want her by default. I want to choose my first black woman president. How's that?
I want anything that keeps Trump out.
I could sign on that.
Yeah, the Trump train, it's like Trump's scary, DeSantis is scary. All of them are like, I mean, it's not even... It's weird to see black people be anti-Biden because you're like, do y'all know what we're going to get? We got Biden and they still are getting rid of the loan forgiveness. The whole Supreme Court on the Republican side's corrupt. Like, it's really bad. If they get the presidency, y'all might as well wrap it up. I mean, it is, we barely survived those 4 years. And a lot of people did not survive the 4 years of Trump. You know what I mean? A lot of people are still trying to recover from those 4 years.
I don't think people don't want a Democratic president who continues the work that Mr. Biden has started. I am pretty sure about that. I think people are just saying, in an ideal world, we wouldn't be faced with this particular choice. We'd have younger options, fresher options. And I think that there's nothing wrong with that. I think it's a weird sign for a country to have so much of its power locked up in people who are at an advanced stage of age. I'm trying to be so nice about this. Tiara, yeah. What you saying, girl? What you saying?
I think that Biden's really going to have to figure out a way to keep black voters engaged. I'm very nervous about it, actually. I feel like there's been like halfway efforts around student debt. I mean, he has done an excellent job with appointing black women to the courts, but it's like that, you know, is that going to be something that people are going to rally around? You know what I'm saying? That I think that is such like a very niche accomplishment, even though it's a wonderful, you know, it's an extraordinary one. So I think that's what my nervous is around. It's like his top black surrogate is like Jim Clyburn, which again, Kai, to your point, Papa Clyburn, we love you. However,
Papa,
did she just say Papa Clyburn?
It is a reminder that
we gonna have to do a little better.
Black people is just not there in this administration, and they think that like getting, Shade Room and Hollywood Unlocked in the White House and some TikTokers is the storytelling, and that's actually just not
exactly.
That's not communicating to aunts and uncles. Do you know what I mean? Like that is talking to some black people. I'm not sure that that's talking to aunts and uncles, and those are the people, or the senior citizens' homes, the black people who are the most consistent voters, have never heard of the Shade Room, I would offer. And I'm team, like, talk to all the press, like, you know, have a wide range, but I do think the storytelling in this White House needs to be tighter because they're doing great stuff. Like, they really are doing legitimately good stuff for people.
Yeah. And I'm not team talk to all, like, like sometimes I see the like where they go and it's like actually insulting to me. Like when you see like where the White House goes to talk to all different other demographics, and then when it's us, it's the Shade Room or the Hollywood Unlocked. Again, I might just be having like a fever dream and maybe I just see things so totally different than other people. But I'm like, are you going to Page Six to talk to white people? Are you going to like Gossip Rags to talk to these demographics of people? Why isn't there like an asserted effort to touch base with us that's not through, I don't know, I hate to say it, but like the lowest brow of our culture? It feels like a little insulting too. So I guess I agree.
I think part of the comms and the digital piece is that you know, and these people, God bless them. They're working at the White House. You know, it obviously it's not a lucrative job, but it's the same folks that have been having these jobs since the dawn of the Democratic Party. And now some of these people are actually like, it is my generation. But it's not people that have tentacles into culture at all. So it makes sense that somebody's little brother is telling them, maybe you should try this TikToker. It's not based off of like a cultural strategy where we really want to engage people in a meaningful way.
But I feel like I'm so, and I don't mean to like linger on this, but you know, only so many times you get to talk to just genius Black people about the White House stuff. But I feel like, to me, when I look at the Republican Party or the conservative or conservatives and stuff like that, they got a blueprint. Even when I think about all these media outlets that are laying off employees and stuff like that, when I think about Breitbart, when I think about all these different types of ways that the conservative party has tried to infiltrate media and tried to stay not just Fox News, but try to do different things. I'm like, well, why can't you just copy and paste that and make it blue? If at the minimum, you know, why does it feel so out of touch? Like there's not somebody else who you have close proximity to, aka Republicans, that are winning at doing it, you know? So
I think the left has tried. I think there are some publications sort of popping up and I think there are some trying, but I do think, you know, you look at, I was with one of my friends who works in politics and we were together and he was like, I'm watching Fox News all morning. He's like, I never watch Fox. And he's like, Fox is just talking to people in their living room, aunts and uncles. And he's like, MSNBC is talking to, they're like trying to talk to college grad, like college, that's like their demographic. And it's like, it is a little different. It's just like a very different thing. So we'll see. Also, Don Lemon, did we talk about him last time getting fired? But it'll be, let me just tell you. So Don getting fired, the way he got fired, wow. But Gayle King and
well, I don't know how he got fired. I know that he got fired.
So he released a statement saying that he got fired that they fired him through his agent. He worked for 17 years. They called his agent and told him he was fired. That was his message. CNN released a statement saying he was lying.
They said that they gave him the opportunity to meet with management and he refused. Yes.
This is really the lead in to Gayle King and Charles Barkley. That's his name, right? They have a new show on CNN primetime called King Charles, and that is going to be a flaming disaster. Gayle is very smart. Charles is very not. I feel bad. I know she's getting paid a ton of money, but I'm like, Gayle is going to be working overtime to make anything that he says sound coherent.
Yeah. There's a joke in this King Charles, the Will Smith slap. That's the movie that he made. Them not getting along. There's something in there. I can't bake it. So. Love Harry Belafonte. Actually grew up with his records in my household. I am a big fan of folk and country music, specifically Black people intersecting it. So his take on This Land Is Your Land, This Land Is Our Land has always like played in my home and has always widened me along with like Odetta. And then there's also just how he has symbolized the outstanding good Black man, like him, Sidi Poitier, like these are like the people I think who have kind of held that legacy. And then when I think about it too, because The Atlantic put out this really cool article on Toni Morrison, gee whiz, Cicely Tyson, Maya Angelou, Harry Belafonte, Toni Morrison, and now Harry Belafonte, there's like a class of Black people in an era of Black people that are gone. And I think that sat with me differently. Eartha Kitt comes to mind as well. I think that sat with me that we don't really have, we don't have a lot of remnants from that era of Black people anymore. So something was very interesting about Harry Belafonte transitioning where it felt like, oh wow, he's gone, which is his own thing, but also an era of Black people who were these kind of iconoclasts are gone too. Gone.
I still think probably one of the dearest memories I have just from TV growing up is seeing Carmen Jones for the first time.
Oh my goodness.
And how beautiful he and Dorothy Dandridge were. I mean, it's just like,
oh my God.
just stunning, just absolutely stunning. So I think that is what I think of. Like, that's what's first come to mind, because it's just such a visceral memory around my identity growing up. But I think what has been truly incredible about Harry Belafonte over his lifetime is all of the activism that he's been engaged with for decades and decades and decades. And so I think it'll be a great loss for organizations that have you know, centered him, you know, gained strength from his life's work. So it is, I know he had a wonderful, beautiful life, I assume, but it is, I think it's still a big loss.
I echo the excitement about Harry Belafonte's activism. I think that we've learned in later years exactly how much he did, from financing a lot of the civil rights actual campaigns and actions to taking care of the King family after Dr. King died. For me, it is a reminder that you can use your celebrity responsibly or not. And I'm always, you know, there was a particular athlete who I had a poster of when I was in college. And when I realized he wasn't using his platform for good, I was like, sorry, dude, you got to go. And so I am happy to support and folks who use their celebrity to help change the world. Thank you, Mr. Belafonte.
One of the things that I always remember about Mr. Belafonte is that he was really in this, not only in his generation was he an active fighter around civil rights, but in this one, he convened civil rights, young people. He like brought us together. He was like, let me figure out, excuse me, how to make space. Gina Belafonte, his daughter, continued that work. Like, that's how I know him. I know her. Like, they brought us together. They continued that work. And there are all these great stories of him really putting his life and body on the line to make sure that activists have resources. And you know, he was a good friend of Dr. King and had all these great Dr. King stories too. So he lived a good life and also did real work, like not just lip service around activism, which I appreciate, which I want to be more of a model for this generation than it is, because posting on Instagram ain't it. Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
Y'all, my news is out of Milwaukee, and you know, I think it's so important to continue beating the drum around Black women's health, particularly when it comes to reproductive health. I saw this article, and it's just, you know, evidently local clinics have been offering treatment for PCOS, and with offering the treatment, women are finding out that they actually have this condition. This condition impacts fertility, it impacts mood, it really is something serious, and many women go their whole lives essentially without being diagnosed. It's much like fibroids, much like endometriosis, where PCOS, you can be struggling with it and having pain and discomfort, etc., and just really don't know why. We're finding now that women are getting diagnosed with it more and more. There's a spike in diagnosis. Now nearly 1 in 20 women nationwide have this chronic illness, and there's no cure. So I think that's the other interesting thing about this, whether it's fibroids, endometriosis, now PCOS. These are illnesses that impact women of color in particular, but there is no cure. There's no treatment plan that works necessarily. But really what it has done is like galvanized, I think, women of color in so many different places and spaces to be, you know, resources of one another in terms of how you can cope, how you can survive these illnesses. So I just wanted to bring it to the pod because, again, I just don't want us to lose sight of these of illnesses that are impacting women of color predominantly. And also, given the conversation around lack of access to abortion, Planned Parenthood being defunded, et cetera, it really is going to have a lot of impact nationwide, but particularly for communities, women and communities of color.
What does this stand for?
It's polycystic ovary syndrome.
This was a really interesting piece. I think, you know, the connection that will always be made is that, oh, Black women suffering from something more than other people or at more frequent stage than other people. Hello. Yes. It's not something inherently wrong with the body. These are just results from environmental and social political realities that end up manifesting in the body because of those things. So you know, just like when we talk about high blood pressure, diabetes, or any of these other things that we kind of talk about, that these diseases aren't just more prevalent in Black women by chance or because of some type of like genetic destiny that somebody can't avoid. Oftentimes they're because of environmental reasons that can be avoided and cured.
Yeah, thanks for bringing this to the pod, Diarra. In the same way that lots of women don't know they have fibroids or don't even know what fibroids are, lots of people don't know that polycystic ovary syndrome happens when a woman's ovaries function abnormally because of a hormonal imbalance. And they don't know the signs, they don't know, or a doctor will just say, oh yeah, you have irregular periods because you have PCOS. And then there's no treatment plan, there's no follow-up, and it causes infertility in nearly 30 to 40% of the women who have it. And so if women, especially Black women, are thinking about having kids and, you know, things are not regular with you and your OBGYN doesn't give you a satisfactory response, go get a second opinion, go get a third opinion, find out what needs to, you know, find out what's going on with you so that you don't end up, you know, further down the line, not being able to have kids, if that's your desire.
The last time I heard about PCOS was Keke Palmer. If you remember when Keke Palmer was pregnant and going through pregnancy, she did a post about, you know, both how hard it was and how people think that it necessarily means infertility. And the Washington Post did a story around women responding to Keke Palmer, talking about PCOS, saying, you know, this helps shine light on hope and the other side, that there can be treatment, that this is something that people can overcome, that, you know, this doesn't have to be, there's not only one story here. And this is both a shout out to Keke Palmer, because I think Keke Palmer is such a moment in the culture and just nails it. And this was the last time I heard about PCOS.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
I'm so nervous. I'm scared. In the pit of my stomach, I'm just really nervous to talk about this. Ooh, when I bring up the name King Jesus, I just feel a pit back to my stomach. So today, I am bringing up a sermon that has gone pretty viral on the internet. I just could not avoid it, and I wanted it to be my news, but then I didn't, and I wanted to talk about it, but I kind of went back and forth in my head around speaking about it, but it felt right, and you know, my motto is always do the scary thing. So this sermon by Jackie Hill Perry has gone pretty viral, and it indicts Black spiritual practices, witchcraft, African spirituality, and it Beyonce and Kalani, and basically says how these women, these artists, and then also these African spiritualities are a gateway to demons, and it's a gateway to and basically there's this modern idea that African, that in order to be really Black or be really pro-Black, you need to practice African spirituality, and that's a white supremacist lie, because Black people on the continent of Africa didn't know Jesus. That was essentially her argument. I think in order to kind of like raise above the argument, I think what makes me mostly sad about this scenario is that there is so much collapsing that happens in African spiritualities, in Caribbean spiritualities, in the Black church, it's interesting. I was talking to Diarra about this last week. I've actually made art projects that actually put put side by side somebody catching the Holy Ghost, somebody in a voodoo ceremony, how people move, how people talk in these different ceremonies, and show that although they might be happening in different vessels and in different circumstances, in different areas, they're actually extremely similar. They're actually a lot alike. And something like this makes me sad because it's going viral, and to me it only furthers the gap between people who have different spiritual beliefs inside of the Black community. And you might say, so what? What you do with your spirituality is your business, and it's not our business. But Black people, no matter if you're Christian or not, are very serious about their God or gods. Or very serious about their beliefs. So these type of differences are actually kind of fundamental in us getting along, and us seeing each other, and us respecting one another. And something like this going viral, because I saw, you know, my timeline feed is what you would think it is, you know, people with pronouns and astrology signs in their Twitter bios. So, like, they were all like, they all pretty much agreed that this was, like, trash. But it made me sad because I do believe there are people who have had their own awakening or spiritual revelation through Christianity. And I do believe there are ways to practice something within love. And I never want to judge somebody's way to the light. And it just feels like there's such a harsh divide happening because we can't collapse those things. I don't know what Beyonce has done to these people. Old church girl. Church girl really, really started it. But it really has upset a lot of people. And again, I think maybe Black is King didn't get as much get as much attention as Lemonade has, and of course as Renaissance has, but Black is King really challenged a lot of people and drummed up a lot of controversy because it's depictions of African orishas and African deities, her saying in the Black Parade that Solange is a child of Yemaya, she's a child of Oshun. And I think there's nothing wrong with understanding different modalities of how people navigate the world and the divine world. And this just made me sad. It made me feel like this divide is thickening instead of collapsing. And I think there was so much evidence of it actually collapsing to me for a long time. And this reminded me that, no, there's still a very strong section of people who are not open-minded enough to think that there are other ways that you can no God or gods or the divine than the one way that they've been taught.
There's like a whole thing to be said about both the history of the Black church, but also this current moment that is, you know, I actually had avoided listening to this. I saw it on Twitter, like the video. I saw the video. I wasn't listening to it. Then you put in the thing for your news. I was like, I guess I gotta hear old girl say her thing. And, you know, there's so much guidance that people need that I'm always like, how did we get to that? Of all the things, people need a lot of help. They need a lot of messages. And you're like, of all the things to tell a congregation, this is the guidance in there. Like, if this is the only lesson you get to give until next Sunday, I just don't even know how we got to. At one point, she literally says, like, all the witchcraft in your house started away. You're like, girl, what are you talking about? So that, there's like a part of it that I was like, I don't even know how we got here. Like, what was the thing that got you to do this? The second thing, though, it is so interesting to see the way that people like her don't even reckon with the complexity of the way that Christianity has been wielded as a weapon and as a tool of oppression. And because she was no James Cone, let's be clear. Like, that's not what she was giving from the pulpit. She was no Christianity as a revolutionary tool and an act of redemption. She was talking about white Jesus. You're like, well, girl, I don't even know. You haven't even done the work to understand the other side of Christianity and Blackness. And that's what disappointed me just as a scholar. It was like, wow, this is a shallow teaching, if I even give you that it's a teaching at all. And the third thing is that I don't know what accountability looks like for pastors, like not only legal accountability, but, you know, if teachers got in classrooms and said 3 + 3 = 24, we would say you can't be a teacher anymore. And I don't know. I'm interested in like, who is the person that says this is theologically unsound, right? Or this is like historically inaccurate and we have a responsibility to at least say out loud that you should be able to say things like that. And I, you know, other pastors saw that and know it's crazy. And it makes me think, Miles, you always do a good job of taking these cultural moments and zooming out. The zoom out I have on this is like the damage that happens in network when we allow things to just go on that we know are wrong. And the church does that a lot. Like, you know, they know this is theologically unsound, but we won't get a Cornel West. We won't get, not that it's his burden, but we won't get a set of pastors who publicly are like, yeah, that was wrong. And we lose when that doesn't happen.
Miles, I think you said something about narrowing and reductionist, and that is what this sort of brings to mind for me, this idea of a narrowing of perspective. There's only one way to access the divine. And I don't know how you can believe in a God who has created so many different people, so many different cultures, so many different ideas, such variety and diversity in the world, and then be like, oh, but there's only one way to get to him, right? And so that, I think, is a fundamental, it is a reflection, as DeRay said, of supremacy and power. Only my religion is the right religion. And as Black people, you know, my greatest hope for us is that we all get free, and we're not going to get free this way. And so, Sister Jackie, I'm praying for you, just like you praying for the rest of us. I hope you get free. My news this week is really out of a kind of, it's a small thing, kind of, but you just can't believe that it's happening. It comes out of Hammond, Indiana, and a bunch of places across the country. Hammond is just the place that they happen to examine for this example. But it's about trains and how trains are blocking intersections, 5, 6, 7 intersections, multiple miles long, for hours on end. And so students are risking their lives to get to school. They're climbing over trains. They're squeezing between and crawling under train cars with their Frozen and their Space Jam backpacks. There's actually video, if you click on the link, and you see these little babies climbing in between trains. The trains can actually move at any time. People can get hurt or killed. And this thing has been happening for decades. Ambulances and fire trucks can't get to people in an emergency. And this has been happening, as I said, for decades, but it's getting worse. Why is it getting worse? It's getting worse because there is a new money-making strategy on the railways, and that is to make the trains longer and longer and longer, longer than they've ever been in the history of railroads, because longer trains move cargo faster than ever and require fewer workers, which makes the railroads more and more money. Pedestrians who are trying to cut through have been disfigured, they've been dismembered, and they've been killed. In fact, one Pennsylvania teen lost her leg hopping between rail cars as she rushed home to get ready for the prom. It is insane, right? This is Hammond, Indiana, is a city of 77,000 people. It is mostly Black and Latino. 86% of the kids in the school district are on free and reduced meal status, which means that school is usually the place that they get their most regular meals. And these babies are climbing under trains and hoping that the trains don't move because that's the only way for them to get to school. The villain in this story is Norfolk Southern Train Company. And the school superintendent, I call them the villain because they seem to be nonplussed about the fact that this is happening. Now, they say that they're working on it and they're going to see if they can get their trains to give louder warnings before they start moving. But they also have a ton of justifications as to why the trains need to be that long and why they need to stay there for hours and why they can't do anything different. The superintendent of schools asked for the train schedules just so that they could figure out when it would be safe for kids to cross. The company disregarded the requests. The mayor has asked for cooperation with the train company, Norfolk Southern. And he was told that the rails were here first. It seems the town built up around the railroad tracks. He says Norfolk Southern doesn't respect him and they don't care about the city of Hammond. And there's a lot of things that the train company could do, but they don't seem to be urgent about it at all. State officials who watched these videos were shocked to see these babies climbing across the tracks and through the trains. And there have been a lot of different interventions attempts to give tickets to the train operators when they stay for longer than a certain amount of time. But then the company sues and that gets kicked out because the only people who can regulate the railways are the federal government. The U.S. Department of Transportation with Secretary Pete Buttigieg says that they are going to help alleviate the blocked crossings through a new grants program. The federal government has put in $3 billion into the program over 5 years to incentivize people to deal with this blocked crossings issue. But seems to me that you shouldn't have to incentivize people to not put children and first responders in harm's way. Since 2019, in Arkansas, Iowa, Kansas, Georgia, Nebraska, Virginia, Washington, Arizona, and other states, lawmakers have proposed legislation to shorten the length of trains just to like 1.4 or 1.6 miles. But every proposal has died before coming law. And the railroad companies say that it's the unions who just want to create jobs and all of this stuff. But the truth of the matter is these people are making more money than you could shake a stick at. Derailing trains. We've seen lots of derailments because the trains are so long, releasing toxic chemicals into communities and whatnot. But when we're at the point where we are endangering children from getting to school, I mean, one teacher said that many of her students, the majority of her students are actually late to school multiple days a week. Teachers have to cover other teachers' classes because people get trained. It's a verb, meaning you get stuck and can't cross because the train is in the way. For hours on end, I just feel like, what kind of country do we live in where we can't create some kind of enforcement or mechanism for kids to get to school without climbing through and under train cars? This was really, it was shocking to me. And I do suggest that you pull up the thing and watch the videos of these little kids literally climbing in between trains that could move at any moment and kill them. It was staggering, and that's why I brought it to the pod.
Kai, it was also a Norfolk Southern train that derailed in East Palestine, Ohio. It's the same company. This is wild.
Surprised?
Wild.
I always think about how if you cannot, in situations like this, if we can't figure this out, what can we figure out? Like, that's what comes, like, there's really nothing substantive for me to add to the issue. If it's very obvious, it's very black and white, it's very villain hero, villain victim, like, victim. But when I do think about situations like this, I'm like, well, if we can't figure this out, with the kids wanting to go to school in the, like, you if this was written in a comic book, we would say that it was just too oversimplistic. It was too easy. So the fact that we can't figure out this behavior or in fight for children to go to the school safely, somebody lost their limbs, kids are missing hours of school. If we can't figure this out, then it really does make you question the destiny of, you know, the kind of ongoing battle of America corporation versus the people. You know, it kind of, it really makes you question it when these type of situations aren't just immediately remedied.
And I think what it does take is something really, really tragic happening, which is sad. And I think that's the case now with the derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, is that now this company is under federal scrutiny. Go ahead.
I was going to say, did I hear wrong? Did Kai say a child lost their limbs going to the prom?
I think more than that. I think, like, and I don't even know what that construct around right. that tragedy would be. Right. But I think just like in East Palestine, it is like toxic chemicals pouring into a community at a rate that is just, you know, you can't deny that. And I think that is that's what it's going to take, which is, you know, Miles, just to your point, like that is the sad part. Like it has to be so tragic, so glaring that then someone's like, oh, well, maybe we should do something about this. Or maybe we should hold this company accountable. Because even before I'm reading prior to the derailment in East Palestine, this company had over nearly 300 whistleblower complaints to OSHA. So it's not, it is just in this case, this company knows what this community is going through, what these children are having to do, that they've suffered life-altering injuries. And their response is, we were here first. Child, please.
It goes without saying that if this was white kids, they would never be forced to crawl under the railroad. Like the fact that this is poor black kids in a neighborhood that looks like that, like people are like, they should be happy they get to go to school. Like I can totally.
But DeRay, these communities are poor white and black communities and they don't care. So I think, I don't even know if they would care that they were white necessarily, because it's more about communities just not having resources or not having a voice than it is anything. East Palestine is a completely white town that voted for Donald Trump.
There we go. Yeah, I do think this, you know, crawling, like maybe it's just because all the images that the news put up was all black kids, that it just like, just feels like it nails it into me. But, you know, shout out to journalism, because if not for journalists, this, like, imagine how long this had been going on before somebody wrote about it. And you think about all the newsrooms that are closing, you think about all the stories like this that haven't gotten any shine, that people haven't been talking about, but this is like real people's lives. They have been living it. And if there's a case, this to me was such a case for journalism. Like it took somebody being like, hey, we're going to like devote space to this. We're going to make sure we tell this story. I'll just echo what everybody else said. I couldn't imagine, like, life is already hard. The idea that you have to make sure your child crosses the train tracks correctly in the morning just feels so wild, given everything else you got to do to make sure your kid goes to school well already. Like that makes me nervous as a teacher. That makes me sad as an uncle. I'm like, there's already enough to do. There is a good story. Or like it's a bad story, but shout out to journalists for bringing it to light. So when it's about jail, it's about jail and prison. So when you get incarcerated and you owe money, so either you owe court fees or you have restitution as a part of your sentence, so you stole a lot of money, you got to pay it back. There was an article about R. Kelly, quote, sitting on a ton of money, like not necessarily paying restitution right now. And it made lawmakers in Washington upset in both parties. So they are proposing a rule that says that you have to pay 75% of the money that you get in that family and friends send to you 75% of it automatically goes to paying your debts. Now, in theory, that sounds sort of interesting. Like that, I can see people who are like, you know what, this is accountability. You shouldn't have done the thing to go in jail, blah, 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 blah. The challenge is that you make almost no money for working in prisons. I mean, like literally no money. So there's a guy who wrote about this, and he was saying the highest paying prison job he had was $3.90 a day, and 50% of it went towards restitution. So it would have taken him almost 18,000 days before he would have ever been able to call a family member, because he just wouldn't have been able to get enough money. He also wrote about another guy he was in prison with who had a $900,000 court restitution, and he was forced to divorce his wife. Like the restitution process, it's like one of the things that's interesting about how we talk about prison and jail in public is that it's very, for all of the imagery and popular in the popular conversation, it's a pretty flat image. It's like, do a crime, go to prison. And maybe there's some contours around how people build community in prison, bad guards, but there's actually like a whole economy of the way we exploit people once they're in prison that we actually just have not represented well in the public conversation, certainly not in the media. And this is one of them that, like, yes, people might owe money because they stole money or the court fees. I'm always like, just wipe out the court fees. But if they got to pay people back, but it's like we pay people so little who are incarcerated, and to take 50% of it is wild, to take 75% of it is wild. And what you're doing is forcing people back into situations where they will make choices that people don't want them to make, or you will completely destroy any relationship they have with their family because they won't be able to afford phone calls or emails or anything like that. And that is actually bad for public safety too. So I brought this here because it's a reminder how random stories do matter. It was the story about R. Kelly that like shifted this conversation at the federal level. And the Bureau of Prisons can do this without legislation, which is also scary. And the woman who runs the Bureau of Prisons is actually, you know, for prison people. She's a relatively fine person. Like I met her. She's not one of the, you know, evil people. But still, this made me sad. And it's like, Lord knows there's a lot to think about.
This just seems so crazy to me. Like, there are so many other ways to deal with this issue. First of all, like, you are mad because R. Kelly and Larry Nassar, both very wealthy people, have too much money on their commissary. Maybe you just say you can only have X amount of dollars in your commissary, right? You can't be balling out in the commissary. Or maybe you make people who are wealthy pay restitution immediately, because there is a way to do that. Like, but the vast majority of people who will be affected by this are not sitting on a ton of money in their commissary, right? And so it just seems like, it doesn't seem like, I think, you know, we've talked about on the pod, charging people for emails, taking books off the list, every single way that we can think of to strip and dehumanize and make this experience even more inhumane than possible. It seems like there is no rock bottom to this. And this just, I mean, even when the victims' advocates say this is too much, seems like we could be able to come up with a couple better solutions than this.
I think you alluded to this, DeRay, when you were talking that, you know, R. Kelly is such a circumstance. So to use him to do other things that affect everybody seems wrong. And a lot of crimes are crimes of poverty and produced by poverty, produced by these circumstances. So anything that we're doing in order to make sure somebody stays in poverty and exploited is only going to make it so they don't choose the right decisions when they get out of prison or while they're in prison. And it keeps this prison industrial complex going. So that's what's really making me sad and think that sure, like Kaya said, let's figure out something for R. Kelly. But now it's it trickling down to everybody else, that's not why everybody else is in prison. And oftentimes when you read and research why a lot of people are in prison engaging in this prison system, it's because of poverty and circumstances. And this is only helping people stay exploited and impoverished.
You know, one of the things, just, you know, from the short time that I lasted as a prosecutor, it was one of the things with plea deals too. You could say, okay, you got to pay $500 to the Boys and Girls Club, or you have to pay $500 to this or that nonprofit. But I remember telling my colleagues, like, y'all writing in somebody's plea deal that they have to pay money to something. Like, that kind of condition is just going to, that person is going to end up being incarcerated again. Cause there's like, so I think part of it is just like, there's a dehumanization that happens. Once you are charged, once you are convicted, once you are sentenced, it's like you lose your humanity. And more than that, people don't look at you as you are, as if you are human. And so I think a lot of this is just such a disconnection around, you know, well, let's have them pay this many million dollars in restitution, knowing that it just is never going to happen. The system doesn't precipitate it. The person that committed the crime is never, I mean, those are special cases, right? I think those aside, if you are incarcerated and you have a really long sentence and you are not able to make money while you're incarcerated, how are you going to pay back that restitution ever? So it's just, it doesn't make sense. Just like as a system, it doesn't make sense. And there's so many levers in that system that are going to be in, that are going to be pulled against you. And this is why we have probably almost, how many? 2.5 million people in prison right now.
And that's why I challenge what, like, a little bit what you just said, DR, because it does make sense as a system if the system is to make sure prisons stay profitable and exploiting people. Then it makes perfect sense. But if it's about people healing and transforming society and blah, 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 then it doesn't make any sense.
And the way that it traps you is just so, it preys on basic logic that unchallenged makes a lot of sense to people. People hear you stole money, you need to pay it back. That logic is so basic that that's how the policies like remain. And you're like, no. But the pay it back, the way we're operationalized that is so wild that they will never, ever meet those conditions, as DR said. So,
and most people are terrified of it. Most people are terrified of it. Like Auntie Kaya, she can't even look in people's eyes when we bring up the prison system. So most people hear it makes a little bit of sense and they just keep moving.
That is the absolute truth.
They are scared to even engage with it because it's scary, you know. And you over here thinking about the time that you might have put some gum in your pocket, and you just start getting the shivery weavies. So I think that's a part of it too. As long as you can make it sound as publicly as possible, then it takes a certain type of bravery to dig into it. Specifically as Black people, it's scary.
And it's also it's always an economic attack, right? Like, it is always an economic attack, charging for phone calls, charging for emails, taking people's commissary money, all of the things. And this is how you know that it's not about rehabilitation. It's not about restitution in that way. It is always about keeping people as economically down as they possibly can, because that was the whole genesis of the prison industrial complex, right? People had to find ways to restore their free labor. And here's where we are.
Boom.
Boom it is. Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. Tell your friends to check it out and make sure you rate it wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts or somewhere else. And we'll see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Evan Sutton. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.